Okay, we're going to come back online now. We've got Lauren Seuss with
TRS.
Thank you.
Thanks, Cindy. Memorable, right? Hi, everyone. So I came from the consulting industry. I have to give the Dr. Schaefer qualification to my presentation. I am totally the geekiest engineer here. So I am not a geologist. My career has focused on remediation engineering. Like I mentioned, I came from the consulting industry 10 years ago now. So it was a recent project, despite what Charles said about the definition of recent. I worked on my first ever thermal remediation project, and at that point in time became very obsessed with the technology. And now I do nothing but thermal remediation for TRS Group. So that's my background. I'm going to be talking today about some of our experience in fractured rock systems and some of our bedrock case studies. But first, I'd like to start just by introducing the technology to folks and diving into the different types of thermal remediation methods that are out there, and then further breaking them down from a bedrock system point of view, which one of those technologies would be most applicable depending on the site characteristics that you have at your site. And then, of course, talking about some of those case studies that I mentioned. So I love to start with this slide. This is a project that we recently completed at a strip mall. This is a former dry cleaner site in Alexandria, Virginia. I'm working on a project right now that's just about 20 minutes away from this project. This was a very simple site. It was only 20 electrodes. This is a clay site, so it's not rock, but as Charles mentioned earlier, clay and rock can have somewhat similar characteristics when it comes to back diffusion from that matrix. So we were, from a contractual point of view, obligated to reduce concentrations in soil to 99.9% reduction. This is a trichloroethane site. Again, this is soil that we cleaned up both in the vadose zone and in the saturated zone. And the one point I'd like to make here is when you're putting all that energy into the subsurface to heat up that matrix, what you're causing is really a phase change. So you're moving that contamination from a liquid into a vapor phase. And when that happens, you're responsible for a 1,600 volumetric increase in the size of that molecule. It's massive. That's truly what makes thermal remediation so effective, is that phase change. That molecule becomes very easy to capture when applying a vapor steam recovery system. Sometimes you also have to use liquid recovery too. It just depends on the technology and some of your site features. But we can go into that with a little bit more detail later. So it's really that expansion that occurs when you're getting to temperatures that create that phase change. Now, diving a little bit more into the value of in situ thermal remediation, again, it offers that certainty when it comes to getting to specific concentrations. For me, as a manager of these projects, it's not when I will get to that specific remedial goal, it's not if I will get to that specific remedial goal, it's when I will get to it. So it's a difference of 3.5 months versus 4 months of thermal operations of these systems. So we know that we will get there. There's lots of different matrices that we deal with. We're typically in clay and also more recently working in the rock matrices. So, it sort of doesn't matter in that world. We just need to select the right technology to heat up whatever that matrix is. As I mentioned, it's very fast, this technology. It takes a few months to design, takes a few months to build. Once you start operations, depending on the contaminant that you're going after, you're typically operating these systems somewhere between 3 to 6 months. Again, going to very low parts per billion level, final concentrations, in, you know, soil, even achieving NCLs in water, just depends on what your goals are. We can fine-tune how that system's designed, fine-tune how long we operate it to get to that remedial goal. And then, of course, once we begin to operate these systems, there's some temporary drawdown that can occur when you're working in the saturated zone. So you even start to pool water in from outside of your thermal treatment volume for additional sort of enhanced treatment from the outside. You also leave behind a nice residual heated volume. And we've got one of the industry's experts in the room, Tamsin, on heat-enhanced processes. We work quite a bit together in the heat-enhanced processes world. But, you know, you can even use that heated volume to enhance naturally occurring processes long after the actual system has been demobed from a site. Perhaps there's even strategies in just using a thermal remediation technology to get to a low temperature, like 50 degrees Celsius or 70 degrees Celsius, again, to enhance naturally occurring processes, abiotic and biotic reactions. I won't talk about that any further. If you guys are interested in hearing more, we could always have a sidebar conversation. Of course, ask Tamsin. She's really the expert. So diving into the different technologies that we deal with, thermal conduction heating is the top technology here that's listed on this slide. Thermal conduction heating is governed, the type of heating is governed by the thermal conductivity of that material. So you install a heater well, into the subsurface, and that heater well is super hot. It's a super heated heat front that travels radially from that well out into the matrix. And it's governed by heat transfer from soil particle to soil particle. So you just wait for that heat front to move throughout the subsurface. And eventually those heat fronts overlap, and it's during overlap that's when you meet your remedial goal. This is a really great technology. You can get to temperatures that are even beyond the boiling point of water. Sometimes with specific contaminants, you might need to achieve those high temperatures. You need a specific site condition in order to achieve that, which we could dive into a bit more detail later. But thermal conduction heating is a very powerful heating technology. There's also electrical resistance heating. This is a heating technology that's governed by the electrical conductivity of the material. So you need to be able to move electrical current amongst the subsurface through the matrix in order to achieve this type of heating. You need moisture and water as part of that matrix in order to conduct that electricity out into the nearby electrodes around it. Ultimately, it's the resistance that current encounters is what's heating up the water, the soil, the rock. We can push electrical current through rock, and I'll get into more details about what type of rock that we've been pushing current through. There's a place for electrical resistance heating, and there's also a place for thermal conduction heating. Again, it's just fine-tuning which technology is most appropriate for your site. And then the last technology is not as common as the other two, but steam-enhanced extraction. This is a technology that's governed by the hydraulic conductivity of the material. You need to create steam, ex situ, and then inject it into the subsurface and push the steam through the subsurface, typically to recover or enhance like a NAPL recovery effort that's occurring at a site. This is a really powerful tool when you have like a transmissive aquifer or transmissive fracture network. Steam can be very applicable. It is limited, though. You need to be able to move that fluid through the subsurface. So again, that's why it's governed by the hydraulic conductivity of that material. You're not going to be able to push steam through the competent rock. You're not going to be able to push it through clay, for instance. So steam definitely has applicability in the thermal world, but it's not going to work at every site. So comparing those three technologies from a temperature point of view, steam and electrical resistance heating, of course, these are technologies that are limited to the boiling point of water. When I say the boiling point of water, you might notice I've plotted these technologies against typical contaminant boiling points that we deal with. We've got some chlorinated solvents on the left-hand side of this slide. We've got some petroleum products in the middle, and then some semi-volatiles and PFAS off to the right-hand side. So when it comes to steam and electrical resistance heating, take note of the fact that I have plotted those two technologies at temperatures that are actually higher than the boiling point of water. That's because I'm referring to, in this slide, the boiling point of the particular contaminant. And I'll get into that issue in another slide. But electrical resistance and steam-enhanced extraction are really limited to, again, the boiling point of water, whereas thermal conduction heating, there's two different types of thermal conduction heating. There's low-temperature thermal conduction heating. I say low-temperature, but it's really, you're still achieving temperatures that are around the boiling point of water. That's your goal. And then there's high-temperature thermal conduction heating. When you've removed water from the matrix, say you're in the vadose zone, or you've got an ex situ cell, or you're dewatering at a site, which gets very complicated, but there's certainly applicability of high-temperature thermal below the saturated zone. In that high-temperature setting, you are actually able to get to temperatures beyond the boiling point of water. And that's what we're doing right now in that PFAS world. There's been a lot of cool projects with semi-volatiles that have gotten to really high temperatures. So getting back to the boiling point, boiling points are what I deal with. Well, can we boil that contaminant, and at what point are we boiling it? So 1,2-dichlorobenzene is a great example. 1,2-dichlorobenzene is a contaminant that boils at 179 degrees Celsius, which is really high. You take, you know, a vial of 1,2-DCB, put it on the table right here, and it'd be boiling at 179 degrees Celsius at atmosphere. And then a nearby container of just pure water, of course, is boiling at 100 degrees Celsius at pure atmosphere. When you add those two compounds together, water and 1,2-dichlorobenzene, and you form what's called a positive heteroazeotrope. This is where I really start to geek out, so excuse me here. But the formation of this positive heteroazeotrope means that those vapor pressures become additive due to Dalton's law. So what you have is a depressed boiling point when 1,2-DCB is present with water. And where do we find these contaminants, right? In the subsurface, when they're present with water. So 1,2-DCB is a contaminant that we typically clean up when we're at boiling point, or when we're boiling at around 99 degrees Celsius, 100 degrees Celsius. So it's a pretty amazing formation, this positive heteroazeotrope that forms with these organic compounds, really powerful in the thermal remediation world. This is just a beaker test that was performed in our laboratory back in the day. This is 1,2-DCB shown boiling. You've got water that surrounds the 1,2-DCB napple there that's been dyed for the color effect, and you see it boiling at a temperature of 98 degrees Celsius. So this is pretty powerful for us. This is why thermal is so successful in my world. We've got a project operating right now down in the D.C. area where we're getting to MCLs of dichlorobenzene because of this formation of a positive heteroazeotrope. So just revisiting those three different technologies that I described and some of their sweet spots here, got electrical resistance heating. Its sweet spot is really VOCs. Electrical resistance heating can also be used really well. It's a nice uniform heat. So if you want to target a lower temperature below the boiling point of water, electrical resistance heating is this nice uniform heating of the matrix that occurs during ERH. So low temperature remedial applications and really targeting VOCs. Thermal conduction heating, you're going for VOCs, of course, or those high temperature boilers, so SVOCs, PFAS. When it comes to steam, again, you're very limited, right, in the in the application of steam. So you're using that technology to target transmissive aquifers. And then, of course, there's always combinations of these technologies, right? There's not, there, you know, sometimes one of these technologies fits your site, but other times you might need to combine them. One of my first ever thermal remediation projects, it was an ERH and steam site, for instance. And then, of course, we've talked about enhancing some of those naturally occurring processes. So I'm going to dive into a little bit more detail into ERH and then thermal conduction heating, because those are really the two technologies that our experiences have been in bedrock. I also find that those are largely going to make up the thermal remediation projects in rock, because steam, again, is just so limited. ERH, you connect our power control unit, which is back here, to the utility grid. You take that voltage and you apply voltage out to the subsurface, varying voltage. We modify that voltage using our transformers. We could also have some field transformers, and send that electrical current out into these vertical installed electrodes. Again, it's the resistance the current encounters that's uniformly heating up the subsurface. So when I say uniform, I mean the actual electrode and the material between the electrodes is the same temperature. It's a nice, uniform, consistent heat. So you're heating up the subsurface to temperatures where you're boiling those contaminants. So you're also, most important part about a thermal remediation system is to have that vapor and liquid recovery system in place. So while you're heating, you're also recovering vapors, collecting those contaminants, collecting the steam that's being generated, and then treating all that, processing it, and then treating it at the site. So electrodes can look like lots of different things. Here's a sheet pile that's going in the ground. We love sheet piles. Sheet piles are not going to be applicable at bedrock sites. You need to be able to advance that into the subsurface. Instead, we would use sonic driller to install the electrode infrastructure into the subsurface. Most typically, it would be a vertical board electrode. Here at this, in this figure, you can see this is a site in New Hampshire where we actually did a high angle electrode to just avoid going inside of the building. This was a very active manufacturing facility. So we're outside in the parking lot doing a very high angle to get to the treatment area that we were targeting under the building. Thermal conduction heating, going into a little bit more detail on that front, you've got a what we call a flex heater technology, a flex heater element. It's almost like a slinky. It's one wire that operates when on at one temperature, very high temperature. This is hundreds of degrees Celsius is what that wire is. When we coil that wire like a slinky, we can vary the coil density so we can target higher temperatures at depth or lower temperatures, depending. It really just depends on the type of site. So we might coil things and increase the density once we get into rock, but then stretch out that coils in the overburden to be slightly more energy efficient. For us, it's all about energy efficiency. So when it comes to these projects, you save on energy, you save on the bottom line. So we're constantly referencing energy efficiency in our world. It's a very small diameter well that is installed. Again, you need that heater well. It's a very small diameter, a couple inches, 3 inches in diameter that we install that wire into. And it's infrared radiation that ultimately transfers that heat from the wire out into that steel case. And then you're governed by thermal conductivity of that material. That's how the heat front moves out into the subsurface, is from that soil particle heat transfer. So this is what thermal conduction heating from our point of view looks like going in the ground at a site in Madison, North Carolina. You can see the slinky on the right-hand side. You've got that white disc. It's just a ceramic disc. We're using that as a spacer to prevent that wire from short-circuiting on that metal casing. And then, of course, you see it all energized on the left-hand side. red hot, just like your toaster, essentially just like your toaster. So comparing these two technologies in the bedrock world and how we would select which technology would work in depending on the type of rock that you have. I've divided things. We've got an ERH bubble on the left-hand side and then a TCH bubble on the right-hand side. We've done a lot of testing in our laboratory. We've taken rock cores from lots of different sites, and we always, when it comes to rock, we always recommend taking advantage of our laboratory and sending a core. So we like to have those cores test the resistivity of the rock before selecting the type of technology that we would use. We've got a ton of experience right now in sandstone, siltstone, and shale. So I don't know if we would need to do testing for those bedrock types. That being said, our VP of engineering who runs our lab would probably love to get a hold of rock cores, so I shouldn't say don't send them to us. But nonetheless, we're looking for, again, we've got to be able to push that current through the rock, and the resistivity testing allows us to make sure that we will be able to do that. So that is going to allow us to select ERH as a technology. And I'm pushing towards ERH here because if you can use ERH, ERH ends up being more energy efficient in comparison to TCH. So again, going back to my earlier comment, if you can get away with ERH, it's going to be the cheaper of the two technologies. But you need to be able to move that current through your rock. And so if you can't do that, ERH is not going to be effective, right? You're going to have to default to TCH for a slightly bigger dollar value, but that's okay. That's a technology that will work. So when you've got a resistive bedrock system like igneous rock, metamorphic rock, those are going to lean towards the TCH side. And then in the middle, it sort of depends on the competency, the porosity of the rock. We've got limestone. Limestone can work really well in a TCH system, but it also, we've got a great case study that we're going to dive into in a little bit about ERH being applied there. So it can kind of go either way. Again, depends on that resistivity testing. So this is a sandstone site in eastern Pennsylvania. I'm going to dive into a couple different case studies now. Relatively high primary porosity here. This was a remediation that we completed to 110 feet below grade. We had a 90-foot thick sandstone that we were heating up. We had a very quick operation of this system, just a little bit over a couple months, right under 3 months is ultimately what how long we operated the system. And our goal at this site was to either one, remove 400 pounds from the subsurface, or two, just show that we've reached diminishing returns of the system. So it was a really easy goal for us to achieve. And we ended up removing 400 pounds of TCE from this site. And I'll go into the data a bit more. I just wanted to point out here in this figure, when talking about that expansion that occurs, I get a lot of questions about how do you recover vapors in rock? And, you know, again, if you think back to that phase change and that massive expansion of the molecule that occurs from going from liquid to a vapor phase, it has to come out of that bulk matrix. It needs to move into the easiest path for it to just be present, be itself, right? And typically what you see is good collection from the fractured media. So you've got steam that's being generated in the bulk matrix that is then moving into the fractured network and then being pulled out through the fracture network through those vapor recovery wells that are co-located with this heating infrastructure. So it's pretty easy, despite it being rock, due to that volumetric change that's happening. So what I've done here is plotted some of our temperature data from, again, that same site, sandstone site, in eastern Pennsylvania. I just wanted to show how easy it was to heat up this matrix. So this is 90 feet of rock. The average temperature is just sort of hidden in the background. It's the red line, but this is all of our temperature monitoring point data that was collected at this site. So under, you know, just a little bit under 2 months, we heated to the boiling point of water at this site, pretty powerful, and then operated the system for a few more weeks until we were able to show that we had achieved the 400 pounds of TCE removed. So taking that data from the Eastern Pennsylvania site, that data is plotted in blue, blue dot up at the top. We've got a couple of other projects that we've plotted. These are shale projects that have been completed in New Jersey in the yellow and the orange. What I'm focusing here on this slide is power delivery to the subsurface, to the rock. And I'm doing that just to compare ERH to TCH. So TCH, I've plotted the maximum power delivery that TCH can have to any matrix. This doesn't matter if it's clay, doesn't matter if it's sand, doesn't matter if it's rock. The maximum power delivery that TCH can deliver is going to be about 300 watts. And with ERH, it's a little bit different because the conductivity, the resistivity of that material will actually change with time while you're heating. So that's why you see those lines sort of move a little bit around. And the line represents a moving 10-day average, essentially. That's why you see the line move a little bit. But you've got this rock matrix that ERH is actually can deliver a higher power to the subsurface in comparison to TCH. This is ultimately what's responsible for that energy efficiency that I was describing earlier. When you can deliver power to a matrix easier, it's going to be far more cost efficient for your project. So if ERH, if you can deliver that power in an ERH project, then you're in great shape. Again, you're going to need to have that testing performed so that you can figure out if ERH would be applicable. So diving into my last case study, which means I'll be wrapping up here shortly, this is Redstone Arsenal. This is a project that's near and dear to my heart. About 5 years ago, I joined TRS, and they sent me out to Alabama to operate six of these DNAPL remediations in the karst limestone environment that is Redstone. This is not just karst limestone. This is also the really heavy, heavy red clay that Alabama has. I think this photograph off on the right-hand side was like one of the first ever soil remediations at Redstone over there. Or maybe they're just like burying evidence. I don't really know. But nonetheless, thank you to the Army for delivering the photograph. You guys, I don't need to go over this figure. You guys are the experts in this karst limestone world. But we essentially found all of this at Redstone, sinkhole voids, clay-filled voids, air-filled voids, water-filled voids. There were so many surprises that we encountered during drilling at this site. There was, you know, six different projects where we drilled over 400 electrodes that were installed at this site, you know, at those different project sites, and recovered an enormous amount of data when it comes to the conceptual karst environment that was Redstone. This was a project. This is RSA 95, and we designed an ERH system from a remedial investigation that included 18 groundwater monitoring wells. So 18 groundwater monitoring wells were installed at the site, and several soil borings were also included. And, you know, as a result, we ended up with this nice, you know, long oval, and we're told, okay, design your ERH system. You can expect to find the limestone 25 feet below grade. Okay, great. That's the average bedrock surface. We ended up installing 300 electrodes at this site. So 300 borings versus 18, we found that there was really only one or two locations where the bedrock surface was actually encountered 25 feet below grade. At some locations, we didn't even find bedrock. Other locations, you know, we encountered water and air-filled voids. It was really pretty incredible. So this is just a simple depiction of the bedrock surface at that one particular site. Lots of variability. You really have to be on your toes. We need, in the ERH world, we need to apply a different voltage to rock in comparison to the overburden. So we actually build two different elements within one borehole to give us that control we need to deliver that power to the subsurface. So knowing that bedrock surface is extremely powerful for us, we were in real time collecting information from the driller and then on the side building an electrode and then installing it into the ground. You know, it's really nice when we could just pre-manufacture everything and then drop it down the hole. At this site, we were totally not able to do that. We had to customize every single electrode that went into the ground here. So as I mentioned, there's six different DNAPL remediations. I've talked a lot about the first three. What I wanted to focus on today was just the last three that we completed. RSA 95, as I mentioned to you before, RSA 95 had two totally different NAPL remediation areas, and then there was another RSA 7363 that was right nearby. So we actually didn't even move our vapor treatment equipment at all. We left it at the same spot and just moved all of our electrode equipment to another spot. You add up all the vapor that's been removed from Redstone using this technology. It's over 50,000 pounds of chlorobenzene and trichloroethane. So it's pretty powerful, right? Depending on the type of mass removal estimate you go for, the consultant has also relied on an estimate that is actually more like 90,000 pounds. So it's pretty significant. So this was 95 East. This was mainly groundwater remediation, although there was a very small area that we also targeted the overburden clay and needed to get to a specific concentration. It's 5 ppm. All concentrations in soil were less than 5. There was only one sample that was above the detection limit at this site. And, our goal was to achieve an 80% reduction of NAPL concentrations in groundwater at this site. The way the consultant had defined meeting the remedial goals for our technology was a reduction of just simply 80% in groundwater concentration. So that's what we were there for. At this site, it was a little bit over 95% reduction when all was said and done. 95 West was a big one, so that was the one that I showed of that surfer map that had the varying bedrock surface. The starting concentrations are plotted in the background, so the blue bar graph represents the starting concentrations. And how we made decisions to shut off the system was based off of the data that was that is plotted in the green, so sort of in the middle here. Now you'll notice I want to point out two different wells. This one right here, 1723, and then this one over here, 2662. When the project team got together and received the preliminary data from the laboratory, those concentrations were actually much, much lower. So collectively, as a team with the Army Corps, we decided to shut the system off. A couple months later, we received the final package from the laboratory that showed much more dramatically high concentrations at this location and this location. We'd already pulled our electrodes from the site. We were already operating a totally different system around the corner. And they go, oh no, what do we do now? Well, it's like, okay, calm down. We can use that residual heat that's in the ground to take advantage of it and watch the natural attenuation occur. You'll see that it is actually sped up. So just simply, 6 months later, the consultant went out to collect an additional round of groundwater samples to see where they were at, to gauge on if they would have to add amendments. And already at that time, just 6 months later, concentrations had dropped. So when I talk about those natural occurring processes that can be enhanced with heat, this is significant. These are real things that occur, and we've got some really great data from these sites across the United States. And then our last project at Redstone was 7363. This was a system that we were operating when we got that negative data from the laboratory, and all of our electrodes, all of our equipment at that point in time was dedicated to operating the system, but luckily we didn't have to go back to the other side to do additional operations. But some great reductions here too. So in conclusion, this is when I start talking, so you guys are probably all really excited. Heat, especially using thermal conduction heating and electrical resistance heating for those temperatures that are boiling contaminants, truly do solve the matrix diffusion problem. This is heating of fractures, heating of the bulk rock. It doesn't matter in my world. We build that infrastructure. You tell us where, and we're heating it. Get that mass out of the fractures, out of the bulk matrix. We definitely recommend resistivity testing, again, to fine-tune which of those technologies would be more energy efficient for your site. That's very key in the early stages of design. So it's that efficiency that ultimately drives the type of technology that we're selecting for these sites. Whether if both technologies work, we tend to gravitate towards ERH because, again, it's going to be slightly cheaper, slightly more energy efficient. But if it won't work, we're doing TCH. So it's power delivery, ultimately, and getting that power, the energy throughout the entire project into the matrix. Those are the key design elements from our point of view when it comes to the ERH and TCH systems. And I don't want to exclude steam, because steam definitely has a potential application, especially when you're dealing with transmissive, fractures. There is definitely a place for steam. I didn't mean to leave it out of the conclusions, but I want you guys to keep that in mind. And then also make sure you've got a technology that does offer you flexibility, because when you're installing as much subsurface infrastructure as we are, we always find something a little bit different than what the original plan was. So make sure you've got a technology that can be flexible during implementation. And with that, I will hand it back over to Cindy.
Do we have any questions for Lauren in the room? Oh, I've got a hand up here. Did you like all my quotes of you, Charles?
Oh, I did. Well, really good presentation. I guess one question that I've always had with fractured rock applications, and we've heard a lot about just the complexity of the fracture networks, faults, and myths. How do you ensure that you're not, especially at some of these high pressures you're generating in the rock matrix, that you're not sending contaminants off along some fracture pathways or ways that aren't under control?
Yeah,
the vacuum influence.
That's a great question, and it's one that I hear a lot of. We have to maintain vacuum in that heated volume, so we actually build into our systems. We build into it. Vacuum switches that if there was a loss of vacuum to the system, the heating infrastructure would actually shut down. So it's all about pneumatic control from our point of view. It's all about maintaining that pneumatic control. Redstone actually presented a really nice little side research project along the way, because we did find so many different voids, so many different fractures. There were some that were rather concerning. Like, for instance, one of the earlier projects, we encountered a massive water-filled void in the subsurface, and it happened to be right on the edge of our heated, treatment volume. And, of course, we found it before we operated the system. So from our point of view, we could either expand our volume and contain that entire void, or we went the route of what our client ultimately decided, was to just sit back and watch what is happening in that void. So at that particular site, we saw no significant change in temperature in that void. We saw no significant change in VOC concentrations there. But, you know, if there's a particular fracture or a particular something at the site that has you concerned, I would just say heat is a great tracer. It's an incredible tracer, and it's really easy for us to detect. We can put some infrastructure in place to keep an eye on things during heating. But it's all about just maintaining that control. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. I think we have another question for you from the online audience.
Oh, fun.
Okay. So one of the online attendees would like to know, is resistivity testing performed in the field, or are you doing it in the lab? And in either case, how are you doing it?
Yeah, so this is actually something that is done back in our laboratory. So we take a core, we've got infrastructure set up, and we are applying a current and measuring the resistance across that current. So that's it in a nutshell. Send us the core if you have one that you're looking to evaluate. This is not like a geophysics type of a resistivity application or survey. And if you have, with regards to the resistivity testing, you know, if you've got different types of rock at the site, I'd recommend multiple cores for just, you know, one project, different types of rock, or perhaps you want to evaluate the fractured, weathered rock in comparison to the competent rock, you know, send over multiple cores. We want to know that information. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, I've got one more question in the back. We're running a little over on time at the moment, so we're just going to keep you all locked in the room here today.
Along those lines, I'm curious, does heterogeneity in electrical resistivity or for the other technology in thermal conductivity, heat capacity, does heterogeneity in those properties factor into how you design systems? Do you do heat transport simulation to optimize how you implement these?
It does. Yeah, you're right. So when it comes to the design of these systems, we do take that information into account. And if you see differences in the material, you know, we've got a great database with regards to conductivity of material. So we can really fine-tune things from our modeling. We do modeling. I alluded to applying different voltages depending on the type of matrix. So that's really where you see it from a design point of view. You've got different voltages that are then being applied depending on you know, the difference, essentially. So there's things that we can do, we can build into the design to overcome those natural differences at your site. We can use, you know, different field transformers, too, to step down voltages or to boost voltages if that's needed. So there's lots of different tools that we have in the toolbox to overcome those.
Thank you, Lauren.
Yeah.
Okay, next we're going to go to Alan Shapiro with USGS.
Okay, back again. Alan Shapiro from the USGS in Reston, Virginia. And this is not going to be a talk about nuts and bolts or description in detail about natural attenuation. This is more of an issue with regard to motivating why in fractured rock sites natural attenuation should be on the table immediately. You know, most of the time, at most of the sites that I've been involved with, there is site characterization, various remedial investigations, feasibility studies. You know, there's a cognizance that, okay, they're of limited value, and, oh, no, let's do natural attenuation. Okay. So this is kind of like a motivation for why you perhaps need to start natural, looking at the factors affecting natural attenuation at the start rather than waiting umpteen years into after contaminant discovery. Okay, so monitor natural attenuation. You know, it's currently evaluated as a remedial technology like other remedial technologies. Okay, and this is I'm speaking from my experience in terms of working with EPA over a period of years. MNA, monitor natural attenuation, been successfully applied at a large number of sites, including some sites in fractured rock. Okay, that's, and in general, if, remedial action objectives, we want to restore groundwater remediation to applicable and relevant appropriate requirements in a reasonable period of time. That's, I'm probably speaking to the choir here. Everybody in EPA knows that this is what you're expected to do. Reasonable time is somewhat, is not explicitly stated in regulations, but that's the expectation. And I'm going to try to demonstrate that there are a large number of sites where achieving ARORs in a reasonable period of time is unlikely. It's not going to happen in fractured rock. Okay, and thus at these sites, perhaps we may be thinking about longer than reasonable time frame, and that's where MNA comes in. And starting early to gather evidence for the support of an MNA is prudent. Okay, Dan Goode spoke and a number of people spoke earlier about the amount of mass within the rock matrix. Difficulties in, characterizing the distribution of contaminants. I'll show you some examples where it is, difficult to find source area, source zone, treat the source zone. So there are significant challenges to, applying remedial technologies in fractured rock to remove mass that is causing a downgradient plume. Okay, this is an example from the NOC site that shows of the mass that's there, the majority of mass is in the rock matrix, very little is in fractures. So technologies that focus primarily on flushing or treatment of mass in fractures unlikely are going to be successful, okay? So what's the magnitude of this problem nationally? Okay, and this is kind of like motivating for why we need to look at this at a number, early on in the process. Now, this is just an enumeration. This is from a study I was involved in with National Research Council some years ago, where this was just an enumeration of different types of contaminated sites, and under different programs within DOD, DOE, US EPA, state sites, and a lowball estimate of the cost to completion of those. Okay, so we're talking over 100,000 sites in the nation. Okay, in terms of looking at those sites, some of those sites are low-hanging fruit. You can, they're in unconsolidated material, you can deal with treating them, relatively easy. But there's a large number of sites, large number, meaning 10% is still like 12,000 sites that are estimated from our evaluation that are complex. And restoration is unlikely to take place over decades to perhaps centuries or more. And what's also interesting about those 10% of sites is that it's kind of estimated that small percentage of complex sites, fractured rock, complex contaminants, large plumes, these complex sites are going to consume perhaps the majority of the resources that are dedicated toward remediation, getting to a remedial design. That means site characterization, feasibility studies, at a relatively small number of sites. And using those resources at a small number of sites may not be prudent.
Okay.
We also looked at, you know, this information is perhaps a little dated. There may be more information. What does it mean for a closed site? And, you know, there were 80 sites that we had access to that were delisted from the national priorities list. And from those 80 sites, you know, maybe about half of them really did not meet MCLs, okay? So there were other reasons for why those sites were delisted, okay? So our sites really, are you really meeting expectations? So there are ways of kind of like within regulations, within EPA guidelines, there are ways of kind of like achieving ARARS waivers, okay? You know, one, perhaps the most, you know, there's a variety. I think Rula Deeb talks about ARARS waivers in a document from about 5 years ago, But the issue is, you know, like, are there ARARS waivers? Can you get to a point where you say, I don't need to reach, you know, like, you know, these remedial objectives? And one is technical impracticability, okay? And, you know, one of the examples, one of the poster children for technical impracticability is work that was Schofield Barracks. Okay, this is my one opportunity in basalt. Okay, that's it right there. I reviewed documents for EPA and the Army associated with this. And this is, you know, a highly complex site. You know, water table is hundreds of feet below land surface. You know, there are impacts on water supply. You're removing these water supplies. The idea of trying to find where the source zone is, trying to find, you know, like the plume in this basalt was considered, you know, like an impossible task. So after, you know, a period of time in terms of discovery and characterization and continued monitoring continues at this site, you know, like a TI waiver was granted. Okay, there are other sites where, you know, maybe, you know, perhaps not of, you know, the same complexity, but of, you know, an equal degree of complexity. Another one is this site in Letterkenny in Pennsylvania, where we're dealing with, you know, karstic terrain, you know, multiple operational units. The Army has applied for a technical impracticability waiver, you know, dealing with karst, dealing with, you know, unknown contaminant source zones, continually monitoring, plumes pop up, they disappear, whatever, you know, a variety of, you know, remediation technologies have been applied at the site, including in situ chemical oxidation, and this one has not been granted a technical impracticability waiver, okay? I'm not saying that that's right or wrong, okay? Okay, because when you look the idea at these complex sites, I'm saying there's 12,000 sites out there that are complex. Not all of them are going to be granted TI waivers, okay? In fact, the likelihood of them being granted TI waivers is minuscule. If you look at, you know, the history of granting TI waivers over the last, you know, like number of years, these are TI waivers that were granted, I guess, up till Rula, you know, like I have some additional information that, you know, perhaps this should be updated, but this was in 2011. There were, 77 TI waivers granted, and that was through 2010. And there's a variety of, reasons why these were granted, whether it's, you know, geology-related, contaminant-related, the types of contaminants at these sites, variety of things, okay? So relatively few TI waivers granted. Okay, this is a time history of when they were granted, which regions they were granted in. You know, approximately, you know, granted, you know, like, piece, you know, these sites are not evenly distributed over the landscape, so the anticipation is that you're not going to see TI waivers granted, you know, evenly over the landscape too. But okay, the idea is that a relatively few of these waivers granted, you know, there have to be relatively extreme conditions. So, you know, the likelihood is that, you know, there's a large number of sites that are regarded as complex. ARARs are unlikely to be achieved at these sites in the relatively near term, over, you know, like 30 years, decades, perhaps even centuries. It's unlikely that stakeholders are going to accept TI waivers, and it's unlikely that they're going to be granted. So the likelihood is that you're going to need to look at these complex sites with extended periods of remedial of actions, that you're going to need to document what's going on to perhaps attenuate, you know, contaminant mass over a much longer period of time, a longer period of time than may seem reasonable, okay? That, you know, like something's being done, you're ultimately, you know, maybe you'll achieve a goal, but it's going to be an extended period of time to try to document. So I'm arguing that there is a need to document the existence of natural attenuation, because we're really dealing with long-term stewardship. We're not really dealing with active remediation at a site. We're dealing with, you know, containment stewardship, et cetera. Okay. So that's kind of like a Debbie Downer. That's kind of like a Downer type of approach here, you know, thought process, which, okay. You know, but there is guidance with regard to monitored natural attenuation from EPA about how to go about this. What are the protocols that are used? Okay. And, you know, various lines of evidence, historical chemical data, hydrogeologic and geochemical data to demonstrate, you know, natural attenuation, field or microcosm studies. These are all discussed, okay? I'm not going to go through examples here, okay? This is more of a motivation to say, you know, start day one. Think about this, okay, with regard to your sites. You know, at least with regard to, you know, like the organic contaminants, other contaminants of concern, you know, like I don't have that much experience with. Okay, John Wilson, formerly of EPA, has written a number of articles on monitored and natural attenuation. This comes directly from his work, saying that there are some recent advances, recent being a while ago. You know, there is also some updated information on this, which, you know, given more, if I had more time, I would have, you know, tried to provide an update. But he's talked about some, you know, recent advances, including compound-specific isotopic analyses, you know, correlations, you know, understanding of, you know, microbial monitoring through and looking at specific microbes and under what conditions they flourish and under what conditions they don't flourish. You know, he refers to some statistical modeling which indicates when, under what geochemical conditions, various microbes will appear and flourish. So I would refer to John's work, and there are some other work that has been done recently by a number of other scientists as well. Okay, so what, you know, also stemming from John Wilson's work and other work, there is, you know, what leads to success in terms of monitored natural attenuation. You know, basically your understanding of flow regimes, being able to identify snapshots in time of what this contaminant is doing, looking at microcosm microbial populations to demonstrate their activity. Looking at degradation products. But I have to warn, there has to be a warning here, is that success is not guaranteed. Just because you're going to look at monitored natural attenuation or processes that may impact monitored natural attenuation doesn't mean that it's going to be effective at a site. There are numerous sites where we see this DCE stall. You see TCE degrading to DCE and vinyl chloride. You do not get substantial productions of ethene, et cetera, at these sites. And this is attributed to either, poor distribution of these microbes or insufficient microbial communities and abundances at these sites. So success is not guaranteed. These monitored natural attenuation has primarily been applied in terms of looking at plume scale processes. Very difficult to try to demonstrate monitored natural attenuation over source scale, over source size, over dimensions of tens of meters, because you're unable to look at essentially flow paths, concentration at one point, concentration at another point, to demonstrate, like these convoluted flow paths over short dimensions. This is mostly done over looking at regional dimension or plume scale dimensions. Hundreds of meters of, what migrates down gradient from one location to the next, looking at degradation products at this down gradient location, and building lines of evidence to demonstrate that monitored natural attenuation. Some of our colleagues, Paul Bradley, Frank Chappell, have looked at trying to look at other means of identifying monitored and natural attenuation over smaller dimensions. It remains to be seen whether that is really effective, where you can really demonstrate this over much smaller dimensions as being effective. Okay, so conclusions. See, I can talk for a short period of time, okay. Conclusions, okay. I'm going to argue that natural attenuation, biotic, abiotic processes are likely to become an issue or become of interest at a large number of fractured rock sites nationally, regardless of type of geologic setting, okay? And this should be kind of like at the onset of, the thought process in terms of dealing with these investigations and site characterization and accumulating information. Estimates of attenuation in terms of these degradation rates are likely to change over time. And one needs an extended period of time of looking at how these degradation rates evolve. So looking at, two snapshots in time separated by a very short time frame is perhaps a dangerous process in terms of projecting out tens of years. So there needs to be an accumulation of information over an extended period of time to demonstrate monitored natural attenuation. What are the degradation rates? How the microbial communities evolve as you move down gradient, et cetera. So start early. Okay. So over relatively short dimensions, 10 meters, tens of meters to hundreds of meters, perhaps tens of meters, you're unlikely, you may not have the monitoring wells over those short dimensions to demonstrate monitored natural attenuation. This may be like a plume scale characterization that is warranted. Okay, and that, I think, is all the information I have. There's a variety of references I provide at the end of the document as well. This is not an exhaustive list. Okay, so if there are any questions, I'll address questions.
Let's see. Do we have any questions in the room or online?
Cindy, we do have an online question.
We'll take it.
Okay, one of the attendees has asked, how long should a monitoring program be in order to ensure that there is an effective natural attenuation process happening?
If you look at case studies that have been conducted, these have been done over periods of 10 years plus in terms of looking at monitored natural attenuation. I think the study that John Wilson conducted in Minnesota, he had listed data over a 10-year period. Okay, so this demonstrated, a significant investment in terms of being monitoring with the idea of collecting information to demonstrate this process occurring. I don't think there is, and I don't think EPA protocol.
Okay, we're going to get started back up here. We've got Tamsin McBeth with CDM Smith, and take it away, Tamsin.
Alan actually gave a great talk ahead of what I'm going to be talking about right now, which is understanding chemical attenuation in fractured bedrock. And I'm going to be diving pretty deep into a project that I've been working on in Idaho, actually, in a fractured conglomerate bedrock there that's been impacted by an old historic landfill. We've been talking about a lot today, and which Alan highlighted, we have this issue of complex sites. Sites where you're dealing with difficult chemicals like DNAPLs that have migrated through multiple stratigraphic layers. You've got alluvial layers, saturated zones, fractured, weathered bedrock. Chemicals and these plumes often impact very large volumes of groundwater and impact receptors. So in many cases, what we're looking at is a long-term management issue and really integrating strategies into that management approach that accounts for the nature, the persistence, and the complexity of these issues. And one of the key things that's important in building the conceptual site model to make these kinds of remedial decisions is attenuation, like Alan just said. So again, because of their characteristics, the site I'm going to be talking about is a DNAPL site, and it is a site where you had a surface deposition of DNAPL that's migrated through an alluvial aquifer and down into the bedrock aquifer. Because these chemicals are dense, they sink, and they can impact substantial thicknesses. The site I'm working on, there's chemicals that have migrated hundreds of feet into the subsurface. Because of their low solubility, you have issues with mass transfer. And Charles's talk highlighted that. A lot of things like partitioning tracers or bio are really trying to rely on dissolving out that DNAPL because that's what impacts the rate that DNAPL goes away. And because of these low solubilities, that process can often take a very long time. We're also dealing with issues where you have DNAPL that has that chemical mass that's diffused into low permeability layers, things like clays and silts in alluvium, in addition to the primary porosity or really even potentially fracture zones, but maybe dead-end fractures or very refined fractures in your bedrock that act as continuing sources of contamination. So again, the site I'm going to be talking about today is in Idaho. This is a site where there was an old landfill that was privately run for a number of decades and then taken over by an Idaho county. This landfill area is known as Cell 1. From 1942 to 1992, 1.5 million tons of waste was disposed in this cell, and really largely undocumented. It's just known that a mixture of industrial and municipal waste was deposited in this cell. It's about 69 acres, represents 3 to 4 million cubic yards. The thickness of the waste is up to 85 feet. In the 90s, they actually closed this cell with a 30-inch barrier to essentially eliminate infiltration coming in through the waste deposition area and really try to prevent leaching of chemicals. We have come in and really are looking at augmenting the conceptual site model for this site for some reasons that I'm going to talk about. But in this slide, I want to highlight they also are operating a landfill gas extraction system. And that afforded us an opportunity to go into the footprint of the waste deposition area and collect VOC samples. In this case, the primary chemicals of concern are TCE and TCE, and look at those VOCs in soil gas still within the waste deposition area. And so these pie charts represent the total mass of chlorinated at these different landfill gas extraction points, kind of across the surface. So this yellow area is the cell one boundary. And the color of the pies represents a proportion of chemical that is PCE and TCE, which is largely considered the parent compound, as well as cis-DCE and vinyl chloride, which are considered reductive daughter products. And we did this in part because we're trying to understand how these chemicals were deposited within the footprint of the landfill, where they are potentially leaching from the landfill, and how, because this is such a large area, how that's impacting the downgradient area. And what we've seen is that areas that have high percentages, shown here in red and yellow, of parent compounds indicate there's still a substantial amount of residual mass within the waste footprint itself, but then within the waste footprint, there's also a lot of attenuation, as the majority of the area within the landfill is actually, we're observing primarily reductive daughter products. So within the waste area, these chemicals are attenuating. Well, so what's happened? This is the footprint of the landfill area. This is the old cell right here. And this is the footprint of the chemical plume. This is TCE. That has discharged from the landfill and is actually impacting a very transmissive alluvial aquifer that's also the sole drinking water source for the local municipality. So there's a 2-mile-long TCE plume. So right off the bat, even though there's a lot of apparent attenuation in the waste area, there's also obviously a lot of TCE discharge coming off of this landfill. So this site is very complex because of where they put this old cell, the landfill here. It's actually nestled in the valley of a very steep hillside here, where they've kind of carved out these areas for the waste deposition. And then this is the municipality, and this is the alluvial aquifer down here. And this is a cross-section that sort of goes through kind of north-south, through kind of the boundary of the landfill area into that alluvial aquifer. And up here where the landfill area is, that landfill, essentially what they did is kind of just dig out the waste disposition area to bedrock and then filled it in. But then there's a very steep relief of that bedrock surface, but still a substantial amount of bedrock where the plume migrates through the bedrock. It impacts, this is in the hundreds of feet scale, so it's impacting about 300 feet vertically within the bedrock, kind of coming underneath this mountainside and then discharging up from the bedrock into the alluvium. And so this is sort of a cross-section of that whole, you know, mile-long approximately transect of the plume. This is sort of a just an upfront picture of that. The hydraulics of the system, the water table is typically 40 to 80 feet below ground surface. It usually starts in the alluvium. Alluvial thicknesses both within the landfill area and in the downgradient plume is typically 0 to 100 feet. Varies widely within the landfill area. It tends to be lower permeability with conductivity estimated at 2 to 10 feet per day. Within the alluvial Soulsworth aquifer, it's very transmissive with conductivity. It's not uncommon for them to see 3,000 feet per day. We're talking major gravel zones. The municipal supply well yields are typically 10,000 gallons a minute, so very transmissive aquifer. The fractured bedrock is known as the Starlight Formation. It's a conglomerate. That formation, we typically see it at depths greater than 100 feet. The first about 50 feet of that weathered bed or of that bedrock is very weathered, very decomposed, and then it becomes more competent. But then there's sort of interlayered areas which we don't understand well, where there is obviously deep preferential flow paths, fracture zones below the area that historically had been considered dry. Where the chemical plume is actually discharging into the alluvium. So that was the initial basis of the installation of a remediation system. There was a pump and treat system that was installed originally in 2002. And again, the focus of that system was you've got this cell one boundary here. The idea was that the majority of the leaching and the discharge coming off of that landfill was sort of getting funneled into this canyon area here, which has a relatively thick alluvium, so they installed these RW wells sort of in a transect across that canyon. They screened them through the alluvium and into the very top of the weathered bedrock, and they started pumping them, and they have continued to pump them since 2002. That remediation system typically operates at 30, you know, anywhere from 15 to 40 GPM, and it's removed about 11 to 12 pounds of TCE per year. What that system has not done is contain the plume. That plume has continued to discharge. The extent of the plume, the footprint of the plume is very similar to when this contamination was originally discovered, and so now we're going back and looking at the conceptual site model to say, why is this system not containing the plume? This is a diagram showing the TCE extent. This is the cell one area, so this is kind of focused in on the source area. The RW wells, again, are the pumping wells. And these are the monitoring wells, all the MW wells here. And what these red boxes represent is there's been, in many cases, substantial historical sampling and analysis at all these monitor wells, you know, basically since the 90s. So we have this very long historical record from the early 90s to recent of what the chemical trends are in these wells. And so what we've done, both in the alluvial wells, typically the shallow wells, S wells are alluvium, and the D wells are bedrock wells. So we're able to really look at these long-term trends. Are trends increasing, decreasing, or staying the same? The colors of these boxes represent what the outcome of that trend analysis is. And in this case, we just use a standard kind of Mann-Kendall trend analysis. The green is decreasing trends. The brown or tan is sort of no trend. And the red are increasing trends. And so what this is showing is that these locations sort of down and cross gradient of the extraction system have had increasing trends discharging off property, which continue to impact these off-site wells. So those are these two. And this sort of just shows the TCE here in these trend charts. The other thing that I would highlight is that they're also, if we look at these molar plots, so the TCE is in red, And CIF-DCE is sort of the brown color, and vinyl chloride is yellow, and ethylene is green. So the other thing that really is different about this site is that there's a lot of variability in attenuation of these chemicals at these different depth intervals. So this 113S, we see a lot of just intrinsic natural degradation. The TCE and TCE are getting degraded to CIF-DCE, vinyl chloride, and ethene, whereas this deep bedrock well, it's all coming out as TCE. So what we've done is sort of said, well, the first thing we really want to do is build a model so that we understand this attenuation capacity. And what that means is you have a source, that source is discharging chemicals, and we want to understand what is the attenuation of those chemicals, how are those chemicals breaking down, what is the fate and transport, and what's sort of the capacity of the aquifer to degrade those chemicals to understand plume stability. And it varies. Not just in time, Alan talked about, you know, looking at these time trends, but what we also see is it varies based on geochemistry, which varies based on lithology. So the type of chemistry that you might be seeing in your alluvium is going to be different often than what you're seeing in your bedrock, especially in a case like this with a landfill. So we're building this attenuation model. We're looking at this plume. We're looking at these discharge points from the landfill, both laterally and vertically, so that we can build this model and understand how chemicals are impacting receptors. The other really important thing to understand is what the potential for biodegradation is for these chemicals, because a lot of times, especially for chlorinated ethenes, people are very focused on reductive dechlorination, which is taking under anaerobic conditions, you have dehalorespiring bacteria that take the TCE and sort of sequentially dechlorinate it to ethene, which is kind of the end game. However, there are other degradation processes that become very important when you have mixed anaerobic aerobic pathways, and in particular, these degradation byproducts, trans-DCE, CIF-DCE, 11-DCE, vinyl chloride, they can all be degraded aerobically. So if you have a situation, which we often do in the West, we have these very transmissive aerobic aquifers. We often, in sources, will have anaerobic conditions, but then those anaerobic conditions transition to aerobic conditions. How those chemicals attenuate within those different areas of the plume has to be considered in this attenuation model, because you have all these alternate pathways. And one of the ways that we can do that, and I'm going to show some data here, is by using compound-specific isotope analysis. And what this allows you to do is to take samples in different areas. This sort of shows along your plume, but we also take it vertically, looking at alluvial, looking at bedrock. And what you're looking for is the ratio. In this case, we used carbon-13 to carbon-12. And so your parent compound, your PCE, your TCE, because of its manufacturing processes, has a set amount of carbon-12 to carbon-13. So what happens is that if you have different sources, that ratio will vary. So you can use it for source tracking, but you can also use it both often biotic and abiotic reactions will preferentially act on the carbon-12 molecule. So what happens is that carbon-12 rate gets broken down faster than the molecules that have the carbon-13. And what that results in is a relationship that's shown here, where if you plot the ratio of carbon-13 to carbon-12 as a function of the concentration of those chemicals in your well, if you have no degradation, meaning that those concentration reductions are strictly a function of physical processes, things like dilution. often in our natural attenuation approach, we really want degradation. Often, if you have things like aerobic degradation of vinyl chloride or cis DCE occurring, the daughter products are carbon dioxide and water. So you can't track it. You're losing your mass balance. A lot of times these appearance cis DCE stalls might just be that there's other degradation processes. So this allows you a means, because if those degradation processes are occurring, then you see this what's known as isotopic fractionation. And that means as your concentrations decline along that plume flow path, your isotope ratio becomes more enriched because the organisms are using the carbon-12 faster. So the proportion of carbon-13 increases. And if you see a slope in these lines, both this red and this black indicate degradation is occurring. And that gives you this independent line of evidence to show degradation when you can't get that mass balance. So the other important element in understanding these processes and what's going on in your plume is to really look at your geochemistry, particularly for a landfill like this, because what's happening is where the waste is leaching, it's also leaching other things. It's leaching carbon, it's leaching other chemicals. And what that often does, or if you have an enhanced bioremediation site where you've added carbon, you have driven conditions to where you have no oxygen and you are under an anaerobic condition where you're generating methane. And very often, these methanogenic conditions, methane typically tends to coincide with the production of ethane and ethane. Usually if you have conditions conducive to methane production, that's also conducive to complete reductive dechlorination to ethene and ethane. But as you migrate out, so here laterally, away from that anaerobic source, you get mixing with more aerobic water, you can get these other processes occurring. And this is some data from the landfill site. These are the three wells that are closest to the boundary of that cell one, where it's leaching chemicals. We have carbon, natural carbon concentrations in the hundreds of milligrams per liter. Those conditions have been driven anaerobic. We see depletion of sulfate, we see dissolved iron, and we see methane. So the red indicates anaerobic or methanogenic conditions. As we migrate down gradient in the alluvium, we start to see aerobic conditions return. So those lighter yellows and white in particular indicate the presence of oxygen, and now we've got this mixing zone with aerobic conditions. There's also a gradient at this site vertically because the leaching chemicals coming off the landfill, that carbon is primarily impacting the alluvium or the shallow portion because the waste itself sort of stayed in the shallow portion. Historically, there was some DNAPL. That DNAPL migrated vertically, but not necessarily the rest of the way. So when we look at the shallow intervals here, those shallow intervals are also anaerobic, and we're seeing degradation processes. But in the deep fractured bedrock, we are not. So what does this data look like? So you kind of bring together, again, these multiple lines of evidence, understand what your geochemistry is. That tells you what potential degradation reactions could be occurring. This is the results from our site of this, again, this carbon-specific isotope analysis. We've plotted here the isotope ratio as a function of concentration. This is PCE. And so this is really busy. I'll kind of walk you through. But what we've done here and what we're sort of trying to show is that the relationship, so if we look at the shallow anaerobic wells, which I've highlighted here in pink, those are all the well locations that are in the alluvium, that are impacted by the waste, other carbon, they're anaerobic, we see a very clear trend. So in this case, PCE is clearly degrading in along that particular flow path. If we break that out and say, okay, well now let's look at the aerobic wells, which are both the deep bedrock wells and the distal alluvial wells, and we look at those PCE that we observe there, we see almost this straight line. So this is the distal and bedrock aerobic wells. and these are the anaerobic wells. And you can see it almost plots exactly, you know, here. This suggests that when you get into the aerobic part of the aquifer, the PCE in this case does not attenuate. So in that case, your attenuation is largely being driven by physical processes like dilution. But it, near the source, we're seeing good degradation. This is the result from TCE, and we see a similar trend. Again, the anaerobic wells sort of clustered here, the source wells. We see a good declining slope here. And then when we look at, again, TCE impacts are observed the furthest away from the site. That's what's impacting the receptors. And we see maybe a little bit of a slope, but still very little natural degradation once it gets out into that transmissive alluvial aquifer. So that's telling us a lot about both sort of how the chemicals are distributed and what chemicals are really discharging from the site, what's bypassing the pump and treat system, and what the focus of additional characterization and remediation should look at. This is just a plot to kind of bring home the cis-DCE and vinylchloride results. Near the source term, we are generating these reductive daughter products. However, as we look down gradients from where those chemicals are being degraded, we see a clear slope. So again, even though we don't get a great mass balance to ethene and ethane, we do see a little bit. We are seeing these chemicals attenuate, and it's also the reason why, although we're generating high concentrations of these chemicals in the source term, we don't see them in the aquifer. We don't see them discharging from the site, and it's largely because these chemicals are attenuating. They attenuate both anaerobically and aerobically, and that's containing the plume of these particular chemicals. So the other thing that's kind of nice about CSIA data is that you can assess degradation rates. If you have some information about the hydraulics of the site, you have gradients, horizontal hydraulic conductivities, you can estimate seepage velocities, and then based on the rate that those that isotope ratio is changing, if you compare that to published rates, you can calculate a degradation rate. And so we took some of the preliminary historical hydraulic information where we've got alluvial, this is the anaerobic area, this is the alluvial aquifer discharging from the landfill, and then this is the bedrock aquifer. So of course these rates are very driven by these estimates for seepage velocity and travel time. So if we look at this sort of range of estimated rates, in the alluvium, you know, we're seeing anywhere from say 30 days to 500 days half-life for TCE. In the bedrock, though, we're seeing typically much higher, and that really is being driven by these estimates, which are highly uncertain. So that's the other element of our conceptual site model that really needs work, because we actually don't believe we did some hydraulic modeling and other things. We can't balance our recharge based on the discharge coming out of these canyons, and we think that it's in large part because historically they've ignored the bedrock and said it's insignificant, and so they have not accounted for it in the conceptual site model. And that's really played out by this and looking at these data. So what we've done is taken all of this information, we've identified data gaps to say, okay, we understand now there's multiple sources within the footprint of cell one. There's PCE sources, there's TCE sources. The sources that are leaching out of the waste area are also leaching with other chemicals that we can track to understand that flow path, and that's one sort of attenuation scenario. That's also the area that's largely impacted by the pump and treat system and getting contained better. Now we also understand, both from a geochemical perspective, that the bedrock is significant, that there's other sources in the bedrock that are separate from the waste deposition area, and that the current containment system is not containing the mass in the bedrock, which is largely what is still discharging to the alluvial aquifer. So now we're really looking at, let's build this robust CSM, let's get some information about the bedrock in particular so that we can really understand what's going on below the remediation system, what's going on in the bedrock, and how can we contain the plume that's still migrating from the landfill out into the alluvial aquifer. So we are planning a very detailed characterization, which we actually started a month ago. They're drilling right now. We're going to be getting high resolution. We're doing a boring program and kind of implementing a stepwise program to do some surface geophysics to understand what the surface of the bedrock is around the landfill in particular and through these valleys. We're going to use that to inform placing boreholes and doing a detailed exploratory borehole program where we're going to be advancing boreholes anywhere between 200 and 300 feet, so that we can characterize the stratigraphy and get very detailed information about the rock structure, fracture zones, transmissivity. We're going to be doing borehole geophysics. Ultimately, we're going to integrate all of that into a mass discharge assessment so that we can understand the chemical mass discharge coming from the landfill and coming from the deeper sources in the bedrock. And then doing aquifer testing. So the first component of our program is the surface geophysics. We actually completed this. I just got the data last week, so I didn't have a chance to put it in the presentation, but we did seismic refraction tomography and seismic surface wave and ERT. This is the cell one, so this, the green lines here represent where we did the seismic lines, again, sort of wanting to understand the surface of that bedrock. This is just some examples of the data. We did see a very interesting, we were able to resolve, particularly with the seismic data, the surface of the bedrock, particularly along this north side of cell one, and we've actually identified an anomaly earlier in the talk. They talked about, you know, seismic anomaly. So that's sort of what it tells you, right? It gives you these really pretty colored pictures that tells you what the wave velocity is, and you're sort of inferring where you see that wave velocity change or look really different than what's around it. It's sort of called an anomaly, and then you say, hey, that looks different. Our geophysicist said that looks like it could be a weathered or fractured zone. So we have placed a boring here to try to figure out what that anomaly is, if it's anything. Right now, we are advancing these three borings, one here, one here, one here, again, going deep into the bedrock, 200 to 300 feet. We're getting detailed lithologic logs, and then we're doing a lot of chemical profiling. And one of the things that we're going to do, I think that was one of the talks yesterday, is, you know, the full suite of borehole evaluation. We're going to do the NAPL flute and FACT flute. So we're going to install the flute liners down the boreholes. We're going to leave those in for a few weeks and then pull them up, and then they're going to sample the carbon off those liners so we can get high-resolution chemical profiling. When we pull the liners, we are also going to be doing the flute transmissivity testing so that we can look at you know, filling these up and then look at where the fracture zones are within those boreholes, you know, getting these kind of constant head tests. So that'll give us some information about fracture zones so that we can construct diagrams like this, which I'm pretty sure you went over yesterday, but that's really getting these profiles of transmissivity. And then marrying that with the fact, so in this case showing like TCE concentrations to understand where your transmissive fracture zones are and which ones are actually conveying your contaminant plume. We're going to do full suite of downhole geophysics, so doing fluid temperature and conductivity, optical televiewer, acoustic televiewer, caliper testing, natural gamma, and electrical logs. And the idea is that we'll integrate all these data, the fleet data and these borehole geophysics data, again, get these integrated profiles to really identify and understand what that rock structure looks like, where those transmissive features are, if those transmissive features are conveying water and how much water they're conveying relative to each other, and also getting some information about fracture zones, orientations, strikes and dips, you know, generating stereo nets so that we can really try to figure out how the plume is migrating in the fractured bedrock, which we have very little information about. We're then going to use those detailed conceptual site models to design and build monitoring wells along that transect. So looking at, we're selecting the locations based on the fracture network where we're seeing the most transmissive features, looking at groundwater gradients and flow directions, where groundwater seems to be going, guided instead of by gradients. Again, we had a lot of talks today about how gradients in fractured bedrock is often misleading and that often groundwater flow is driven a lot more by the orientation and the properties of the fractures that it's being conveyed in. And then, of course, geochemistry. So we're looking at probably installing flutes, multi-port wells, or single wells, depending on the outcome of our assessment. Ultimately, we are looking at updating. We have developed a numeric 3D model to understand fate and transport. We're going to use this information to update that numeric model and specifically to represent better or more accurately the bedrock portion of the aquifer and the discharge. Ultimately, I'm a remediation design engineer. We're going to integrate all this information to understand mass discharge coming from the landfill, where that's coming, and then ultimately look at augmenting the pump and treat system. Do we need to install deeper extraction wells? Do we need to install more extraction wells? Where do we do that? Look for opportunities for efficiency. There's a lot of wells out here that are pumping tremendous volumes of water that aren't necessarily capturing a lot of contaminant mass. And so really kind of focusing that approach or deciding that we need to select a different remedy. Maybe this doesn't make sense and we can take advantage of the substantial amount of natural attenuation that's already occurring, that's already established at much of the site and augment that with something like a biobarrier. So we just started, again, we're drilling as we speak, and we're looking at integrating all that data this winter, deciding if we need to advance any more borings. We're doing adaptive iterative characterization program, and then making recommendations next year, probably in late 2020, for optimizing that remediation system or augmenting it. And so with that, I will take any questions. I would like to acknowledge, of course, projects like this always have multidisciplinary collaborators and technical project teams, and a lot of great people have worked on this project. So I want to acknowledge them and then take any questions.
Thank you, Tamsin. Do I have any questions for Tamsin in the room? There we go. Okay.
Very, very cool data you're generating. My question was on the DCE aerobic degradation you think you're seeing. So when you're looking at the enrichment in the aerobic zone, what type of enrichment factor do you have that or know that are you seeing for the DCE in that zone, and does that enrichment factor match up with what others have measured for co-metabolic dechlorination?
Yeah, I hid that on this table. The short answer is yes. We're using the published enrichment factors to calculate the degradation rate.
Okay.
So this min-max half-life is based on the published min-max enrichment factor for, in this case, cis-DCE aerobic staggered co-metabolism.
So, does that match up with the data you're seeing?
It's comparable, like within an order of magnitude.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, I mean, there's clearly other things probably going on.
Right.
I think because there's anaerobic, likely, and aerobic degradation occurring in most of the wells that we actually have DCE in.
Okay.
That's confounding it, or, you know, skewing that the site-specific enrichment factor.
And what do you think the co-metabolite is?
Methane.
So you're seeing methane even in the aerobic zone?
Well, so where we're seeing cis-DCE.
Okay.
So the landfill leachate is creating pretty anaerobic conditions, and this is a terrible graphic, but basically we have certain locations where we have, you know, part per million level methane production that's coming off of the landfill. There's also, you know, there is actually ethene and ethane. I mean, there is, you know, detectable ethene, which can also be a co-metabolite. So, you know, there's potential for all three, really, as well as other things. So the other potential here, and this is actually important for petroleum hydrocarbon sites, is there are aromatics. So there is benzene, there's toluene, and those can also co-metabolize chlorinated. So we potentially have multiple co-metabolic pathways that could be stimulated in this mixing zone where we've got anaerobic, you know, waste leaching with the aerobic.
Are you seeing that in the overburden and bedrock, or just overburden?
We're seeing it in the overburden and the weathered bedrock, which is about the top, about 110 feet. We see aerobic conditions largely in the deeper bedrock, which is generally greater than about 110 feet.
Your recovery system was only pulling 30 GPM out of all those wells. Is that going to be quite low based on that transmissive aquifer? And talk about kicking that up.
Yes, there is a disconnect, and that's a good question. It is consistent with the hydraulic properties of the alluvium in this canyon. So this is the area where the conductivity measurements were more like 1 to 10 feet per day. So they are several orders of magnitude lower than what is observed in that larger alluvium that's the sole source aquifer. So we actually do feel like the remediation system as designed is pumping as well as it can in the formation that it's completed in, and that the problem is probably more coverage and lack of vertical capture.
Okay, I think we actually have a question for you online. Jean?
Okay. So one of the attendees has asked, what are the expectations that your team has about the participation of bedrock in attenuation and enhancement of the degradation process?
Well, we're going to get a lot more information about that. For now, it has the bedrock itself, so it's a conglomerate bedrock that tends to be weathered. We think that the attenuation, at least the anaerobic attenuation, in this case, is really being more driven by the discharge of waste, you know, leachate from the waste. So the bedrock really provides conduits that have different, hydraulic properties that are conveying those chemicals differently than the alluvium. Right now, we, you know, are ultimately, when we do the rock matrix evaluations in the coring, we are going to look at the potential for matrix diffusion, particularly in the weathered zones of this bedrock. It weathers so that it almost, it's like the consistency of clay when you pull up the core, you know, in those really weathered areas. And in fact, in some of the old logs, areas that are actually in the bedrock were logged as gravel zones too, because it's a conglomerate. And so where it's really weathered, it comes up and it looks like gravel. And so you'd see, you know, bedrock, and then gravel. And it's really not gravel. It's this weathered conglomerate that's kind of decomposed. So we think from a hydraulic perspective, it's probably the most important thing that's missing in the conceptual site model. And then in terms of like geochemically, you know, how that could impact attenuation, in this case, you know, we're calculating these degradation rates. We're going to have to adjust those transport pathways to be representative of those fracture zones so that we get better estimates of what the attenuation is in the bedrock, which we don't yet have a handle on.
Okay. I don't see any more hands up. Jean, are we good online?
Yep, that was the only question.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thanks, Tamsin. Next, we're going to go to Henning Larson. He's with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, right? Did I get it right, Henning?
Hello? Yeah. Okay. Has that got a pointer? Oh, okay. All right. Hi, I'm Henning Larson. I work for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality as a hydrogeologist. And I'm here to talk about the Viewmaster site, which I think showed up in the agenda as the GEF site, which is pretty close, but it's the GAF site. So this is where these things, whoops, oh. So we all might recognize these, the Viewmaster. I had one as a kid, and they produced these photo discs that went into them, and they also used some trichloroethylene in this whole process. But it was a local Oregon company founded in Portland and went through a couple acquisitions over time, including GAF and then later Mattel Corporation. So it's a big site for Oregon, one of the more important cleanup sites that we've had. Let's see. Oops, sorry. And here we are. It's in Beaverton or just south Beaverton and up in northwest Portland, northwest Oregon. You can see up here, there's the Tualatin Mountains, which these rise up to about 800, 900 feet and separate the Portland Basin from the Tualatin Valley, which is the adjacent basin. So this is what the campus looked like in the 60s. This facility was built in the 50s. You'll see later on, this is an area of interest, and you see a little bit of darkened soil over here. This is actually subsurface water transport that is going down valley. A picture of somebody working in the facility. And this was an important photo because the TCE here was released in several different locations. There was a production well on site that served both drinking water to workers as well as for processing there. And when the well was eventually sampled in 1998, the concentration of TCE found in it over the three samplings was between 1,200 and 1,500 micrograms per liter. So that's what all the workers were drinking while they were at the plant. Plus, they were working in various different manufacturing processes that caused it to volatilize. And we had contamination beneath beneath the slabs that was causing vapor intrusion. So there was an epidemiological study done because it was estimated that 25,000 workers were exposed and that 1,000 had been exposed for longer than 5 years. And the epi study did identify an increased incidence of cancer of several types, but it was discontinued before it was ever completed. So we didn't get the final results from it. This was important because this was the water tower that served the factory and all the workers. And long after the factory had been closed, the water tower had stood. And finally, enough people in the local community demanded it come down that they eventually demolished it. This is just kind of an aerial view, and I want to show you this again. So this area is just west of the facility. As we go into the picture here, you can see this large wetland feature that's there. Some of that was, I believe, was excavated out and sort of enhanced this. But there was, of course, natural flow. So this is sort of a wetland feature. This is Fano Creek here, this small meandering creek coming through here. And then the two join together right here. So these red, you know, they're not precise locations of source area, or at least the size of them is not very precise. But up here, this was a drain field. There was a drain field here. This was a vapor degreaser. This was, I am forgetting what was going on here. This was just a disposal area where actually they did dump drums of TCE, and I think on the labels that was the recommended disposal method, was to dump it out back. It was thought in the 50s that it would evaporate. It was just volatile enough, but you know, we found that it isn't. And over in here, actually a fair bit of cyanide as well. So the concentrations were pretty high in a number of these areas, and up in this area extend up to 200 feet below the surface. And so these were all surface releases. So pretty impressive, actually, how deep it traveled. You can also see that there's a fair bit more DCE down at this end of the site as opposed to up here. So again, we've got groundwater contamination and we had migration to this body. These blue values were actually in the water column. So we're getting concentrations up to 62 parts per billion TCE, up to a couple hundred DCE, and up to about 100 total cyanide. And it is running with the creek further down, and here's another sampling point. So just regionally, there's three, I'd say, kind of main units out in this area. We've got an upper alluvium, which is really more of a lacustrine deposit from the Columbia River or the Missoula flood deposit blocking up the Willamette Valley, and it developed a lake behind it for a period of time, and we see a lot of alluvial deposition, lacustrine type deposits. It's called the Willamette silt. And then we've got the Columbia River basalts, which are these extensive flood basalts from eastern Oregon and eastern Washington, and then below those, and in the vicinity of the site, there's about 800 feet or so of this basalt, at which point then you transition into a marine sandstone that has brackish water within it, but it's relatively deep below the surface. Oh, okay. I resisted that. All right. I'll use. So this is just going back geologically, this was an old anticline feature from some tectonic compression. Right now, this is the Portland Basin, which is a still evolving basin. And it's caused by some wrench faulting that is sort of opening this basin up, and it extends to about a depth of 1,600 to 1,800 feet in the center. And then this, again, is the Tualatin Valley. And then this is the Fano Creek watershed, and I just put a little strip of that reach of the creek there. Here's a A to A prime cross-section that we'll see here, and what we see is we can see this alluvium or this Willamette silt deposit over the top, and we see different members and flows within the Columbia River basalt formation showing up, and actually after logging and such and other indications, there were faults that were identified. And Terry, did you do some of the logging on this? So I had spoken to Barb Beeson about it in the past. Yeah. So this was very important. These, to the casual observer, Columbia River salt can look pretty similar, but through textures and phenocrys and sort of relative stratigraphic position, you can identify these. And Terry and Marv from Portland State did that in their early characterization of this site, which was in the late 90s, early 2000s. So you end up having offset units, and the flow is typically assumed in these Columbia River basalts to be in these interflow zones of flow tops, flow bottoms, and such, and then the interior is not to be considered very conductive at all. Here we're seeing these faults that are offsetting different interflow units. So this is just a picture of the couple of these units and how extensive they are. So state of Washington, state of Oregon, some of these are tremendously large flows. And I believe maybe some of the historically largest lava flows in the history of the world. Yeah, okay, the largest. Not even kind of. Large, and at our site, here were at least five units or five members of the formation were identified, and these are flowing out of these areas, and it's pretty remarkable. They migrated or they moved all the way out to the coast, but they also flowed over or currently beneath our site. So this may have been discussed yesterday. I wasn't here. But this is sort of what these flows look like in eastern Oregon, eastern Washington. You get, big exposures. This is what it looks like a little bit more up close. We get occasional views in western Oregon, but most of it is pretty vegetated, so you just don't get the exposures. These are actually two of the units, the Sentinel Bluff and the ginkgo flow, which are pointed out in this slide, actually occur beneath the site. So I thought that was interesting. So what we did find through the drilling and through also measurement of water levels was that we had five to six distinct, there's another block that was identified further west, but these different fault blocks. And these were having a big influence on the flow of water. They both show kind of effective or effectively act as flow barriers, but then also ultimately transmit the water to these discharge areas. So they kind of have both qualities in them. And this was interesting too, that some of the wells actually, saline is probably not the right word, more be brackish. But what we knew was that these faults here run pretty deeply and seem to intersect the sedimentary units, these old marine units, deeper down. And this isn't the only location in this area, but we see some wells come up with high TDS, up to a couple thousand, you know, indicating a source in these old marine deposits. And at this location, they're expected to be about 700 to 800 feet below the surface. And so we're seeing evidence of groundwater coming up that far. And this is the only surface water discharge for this area. So at least my conclusion was that basically all the groundwater that was falling within this basin was being discharged through the surface water feature. So here's some cross sections across this, and we can look at the units a little bit more closely. Oops, sorry. Okay, sorry, yeah. Perfect. So this is our C to C cross-section, which is really going along the groundwater flow direction. And so, you know, as we got closer to the, or as you get closer to the this creek and wetlands here, some of these were pretty weathered, and it looked as though positive identification, you know, couldn't be made. Back from stepping back away from that water feature, some of these units were more conclusively identified, and some of the offset was able to be evaluated. Oh, and I apologize. This was supposed to be the TCE plume, and it did not come out very clearly. In fact, this one actually reached as deep as TC, and so what we see is almost 250 feet of migration from the surface and where we think the release has occurred to where contamination was being detected. And there was a few reasons for that. The site had its own production well that I believe ran at around 130 gallons per minute or so. And it was down roughly 150 feet below the surface. If I go back, actually, there's a golf course over here. There's a cemetery over here. They have their own water supply wells, and so those were stressing the aquifer as well. There was also TCE, so a DNAPL release, just like we was described in the last presentation. So we know that it migrated through this upper alluvium and down to the bedrock surface, but based on the concentrations, there appears to be DNAPL migration down into the bedrock as well. This is just another cross-section, and here we're seeing What's that? So, getting directions. I'm having trouble with too many devices here. I'm going to go on. Here's the E cross section. And this shows this offset here, which, you know, looks like we can quantify it at roughly 50 feet of offset between these units. And as a consequence, the expectation is that this is the faults are going to behave a little bit or inhibit the flow through these units just by offsetting the conductive and transmissive intervals. So this is interesting, and this may have come up yesterday, but this is just sort of a generalized view of Columbia River basalt sheet flows and how they have different qualities. So you have the interiors of the flows, which might be these blocky, columnar type of jointed rock, or we have the flow top, vesicular flow tops, flow top stretches. But this is where your flow is primarily concentrated. These, although there's vertical fractures, a lot of them aren't continuous. And generally, these do a pretty good job of separating your individual aquifer units. And this is a couple of spinner logs that were done of nearby wells in the vicinity within a mile or two of the site. And although they're not differentiating these different parts of the flow, you can see how flow through the units are very focused. This one, you know, a relatively narrow interval, producing 55% of the flow in the well. And, you know, similarly, you're getting very focused flow through very discrete intervals of rock. One of the consequences, or one of the unusual things that we've seen, is that although they're very limited vertically, they are very conductive horizontally. And so this is an example of a pumping well here that I believe it was pumping at about 65 gallons per minute. It caused 43 feet of drawdown at the well. Here is roughly 4 feet of drawdown. And then this large contour here is 1.5 feet. This is about 1,000 feet across, and we have this, you know, relatively uniform drawdown, you know, across this block. Like, I'm not sure if I said it, but it's like it behaves like a water tank, in that it sort of uniformly is drawing down the water within this block. These are two other defined blocks. Actually, there's zero drawdown in these wells, zero drawdown in this well. And so we see the block behaving like, or we see the faults really inhibiting the hydraulic response across these. And so it has helped a little bit in that they kind of provide a bit of a backstop for your capture zones, and it allows you to, you know, in some ways to focus the capture in the areas, you know, that you're targeting. But they have to be factored in as you, you know, evaluate and consider containment of the plume. Other side. It's getting worse. So, and I'll show you the map of the wells here. But this is three wells, two that are basically co-located, 1A and 1B, and 8A. And I'll try to point these out. So 1A and 1B are here, and they're separated by, I believe, about 75 feet. 8A is here. And you're seeing these hydrographs, you know, almost in sync. And so, you know, both at depth and laterally across, you're seeing, you know, a high degree of hydraulic conductivity or end connection. This is 2A, B, and C. And so if we go back to this cross-section right here, we can see 2A, 2B, and 2C, and they're separated. 2A from 2C is about 150 feet or so, or 130 feet. And we're seeing those hydrographs sync up almost perfectly as well. And so what we're seeing is a high degree of hydraulic connection both vertically and laterally, and they're really behaving, you know, I mean, everything is synchronized very well. So we would not have expected this, really, because of, you know, what we assume about the inhibition of flow vertically. We know that horizontally these are very conductive units with high transmissivities and conductivities. We don't typically expect that to be happening vertically, although there's the vertical jointing from the columnar basalt and such, they tend not to be very transmissive. So, you know, in this case, in our location, it is, and it may be the wells that are hydraulically, or I mean the faults that are hydraulically connecting the vertical intervals, or it can be just, you know, fracturing, I guess, that has been enhanced by faulting. Oh, Cindy, I think we got to go. So we set up four extraction wells. There's three of them still operating. And this one began at 10 gallons. It's just operated at 5 currently. This was done at 90. 62 is the current, 154. And this one was at 5, and now it's 0. They don't really have enough wells that we can sort of delineate a capture zone real confidently. But there are, you know, we have a couple lines of evidence that suggest that we have good containment in this block. And these wells, their influence doesn't extend over to here. It does not extend down here. This is this was mainly captured by this small extraction well located right here. These are the current concentrations that were, or at least from the last four events that we're seeing. So the initially this was pumped at 200 to 210 GPM to capture these plumes, and currently it's averaging closer to 120 to 140. The system has been operating now for about close to 20 years. It's just a little less than 20 years. And what we've seen over time is that the concentrations in the influent have really sort of stabilized. You see this kind of bimodal concentration here, and they're alternating wells and pumping primary extraction wells there for 3-month periods at 65 GPM, and so there is this kind of oscillation between concentrations that are occurring. But basically, there's no indication that we're exhausting the source. This is on a log scale, and so it kind of obscures really the fact that mass extraction rates and removal rates are pretty constant, and they have not been decreasing. And so there's really no evidence that we have removed a significant portion of the original mass. We're just not seeing declines in either concentration or in the mass recovery. We are seeing, though, what we have are some concentrations in the deeper wells that have declined substantially, while the shallower, you know, wells have remained a little bit more consistent. And the interpretation is that we still have a lot of source mass in the upper bedrock, and that although moderate concentrations, that the mass at depth has been exhausted for the most part. So, you know, a few of the things that we've observed out here is that these interflow zones are extremely conductive. I think we got transmissivities up over 20,000 feet squared per day in some of those interflow zones. But the offset of the faults, we've also seen contours stack up 7 or 8 feet between wells that are just several hundred feet apart because of the presence of these faults. So they seem to inhibit the flow, and they cause, and they do dampen or eliminate hydraulic response across it. But then we see the water also discharging to these surface water features, and we see water discharging from depth up into these surface water features. And so they also appear to be acting as a conduit for flow. And I can't tell which is more important. I guess both, it's just that both are going on. You know, the pump and treat out here, and that is all that has been done. It's just been simple hydraulic containment, pump and treat with discharge. And that has had limited success. What we have been able to do is reduce concentrations within within this wetland and in Fano Creek. And so I did a little calculation, which is they've been pumping anywhere from about 120 to 200 GPM. And so I just looked at the basin as a closed basin. The USGS has two gauging stations along this small stream, Fano Creek. And I was able to kind of back calculate a recharge and discharge per lineal foot of the creek. And I came up with about 120 gallons discharging through this area if you assume that this water feature is capturing all the groundwater flow, which evidence suggests it is. So it was kind of a backdoor method of trying to demonstrate that that the extraction system is containing the water adequately. The surface water data gives us a line of evidence, but we've always been worried about portions of the plume escaping into deeper sections of the Columbia River basalts, because that is the regional aquifer for this area. And so it's been of great importance to make sure that the plume is contained to this site and is not allowed to migrate off-site. So that's really all I had to say. I'll take any questions.
Okay, I think I saw that a question came in online. Jean, do you want to give that to us?
Yep, I will. So one of the attendees has chimed in and wanted to know more about the hydrogeological features that helped you choose the location of the extraction well.
So, well, the hydrogeologic feature were the interflow zones. So I'll just go back. So these flow tops are identifying, you know, the more conductive intervals within these basalt flows. And so we could see, like this, extraction well 2B. The top intersects this flow top here and is trying to intersect the most, you know, transmissive interval within that flow. So that is, you know, one way that the hydrogeology and the interpretation of it affected the location of the, or the screened interval.
Do we have any more questions in the room? Okay, if there's nothing further online, then thank you, Henning. And at this time, we're going to go back to USGS for, let's see, it's going to be Fred Davis. Fred De Lewis.
Okay, thank you. We have several of us coming up for this talk. We want to showcase some new research methods, tools that are coming online, give you a flavor for where we see different aspects of fractured rock research heading. So to give you some ideas for things that you might integrate into EPA work in the future. I'm going to begin this with a discussion of geophysical tools and techniques that I think may be of interest to this group. I'll begin by talking about indirect measurements of immobile porosity and the exchange between mobile and immobile domains or porosity types in fractured rock, ways we can measure those using electrical methods. Then I'll go over briefly the emerging method of nuclear magnetic resonance, which we're using in fractured rock in some studies in coordination with EPA, as a matter of fact, and then cross-hole flow meter logging. All of these techniques were touched on earlier in some way this week, yesterday or today, but I'll try to focus on research aspects of these with a few slides. When we talk about porosity in fractured rock, we're often talking about mobile and immobile porosity, and some of the mathematical models used, including in MT3D, treat back diffusion or processes that lead to rebound and long tails in concentration using a mobile-immobile model. These models go back decades. There are advanced versions of this model with multiple porosity types, so you have more than one immobile domain. But the basic idea is that you are dividing up the porosity using both mobile and immobile components. So instead of having a representative elementary volume consisting of one type of pore space, you divide that into two types, mobile and immobile. And in the presence of this kind of behavior, you don't have one breakthrough curve at a single location. You really have two, one for the mobile domain and one for the immobile domain. Here we're looking at what advection and dispersion would look like in the absence of mobile and immobile behavior. and you get this, you know, very fairly symmetric, you know, Gaussian kind of breakthrough curve. But in the presence of immobile porosity, you get longer tail in the mobile domain, and you're moving mass to later in time. And this dashed line here represents the immobile domain, which is invisible to our sampling traditionally. To get at the immobile domain, what do? We do these extractions using methanol and other techniques on crushed core. So it's a very invasive kind of measurement to get at the immobile concentration in situ. Well, electrical geophysics can help us here because whereas conventional sampling just takes water preferentially out of the mobile domain, electrical methods are sensitive to both domains, mobile and immobile, at least to a large degree. So if we can sense the fluid in the immobile domain electrically, and we can use an electrically conductive tracer, just an ionic tracer, bromide, chloride, any of the tracers we've talked about, well, many of the tracers we've talked about this week, not any of them, but any of the ionic ones that enhance specific conductance, we can begin to interrogate that immobile domain non-invasively with geophysical techniques, specifically anything that measures electrical conductivity or its reciprocal resistivity. And the general approach here is to conduct that tracer test and compare the two breakthrough curves for what we sample with traditional methods, the mobile domain specific conductivity, and then what we get from the geophysics. And we can do this in various environments, and we've done this now both in the lab, as you see on the left in columns. We've done it in the field, in stream beds, using seepage meter type setups. And we've done it at the field scale in between wells using electrodes, implementing electrical resistivity in cross-section or even in 3D. So very different setup than used for electric resistive heating, but similar physics involved. So here I'm just showing the simple circuit diagrams for the voltage applied and the current measured, and that can be reversed depending on the type of instrument you're using. But the basic idea is to measure a resistance and convert that into the petrophysical property resistivity, which is independent of the configuration of the electrodes, the physical property. And we get the two breakthrough curves for fluid and bulk, and we can plot those up. Now, in the absence of non-equilibrium conditions, you'd get a straight line for that relationship between bulk and fluid conductivity. We call that Archie's law. But in the presence of non-equilibrium conditions between mobile and immobile domains, you get this hysteretic nonlinear behavior, as you see in the bottom plots here all across. So the general approach is similar whether you're doing this in the lab or in the field, say in a stream bed or in the field in between wells. You can analyze the data the same way with very simple models. This is what that looks like. This is column data. Of course, column data always looks good. So we got this nice, clean data set, the black circles, and we fit that with a simple model, 1D transport model, single rate coefficient governing diffusive exchange between mobile and immobile domains. When we go to the stream bed, it's a little bit uglier, but still pretty good. This is just showing the data. And when we go to the field scale, it gets a little bit uglier still, but very usable data, just the same. These are two different locations at that site. So whereas conventionally in the past, people have gone after a single coefficient for the diffusive exchange between domains and a single immobile porosity for a site, site-wide values, effective parameters, we can do this spatially. We can do this at very fine scales. We can begin to resolve how these parameters vary in space. So how do we analyze the data? Well, there are some simple methods to do it. If you're watching the fluid conductivity evolve from equilibrium conditions during a tracer test, first you're seeing the mobile domain load up at a given location where you're sampling, and then over time the immobile domain will load up. So what happens there is you're changing the bulk conductivity, but the fluid conductivity is basically staying constant at that point. And then if you flush the system, you'll watch the bulk conductivity decrease on the y-axis, and the fluid conductivity will decrease until you get to a point where the mobile domain has cleared out and what's left is just the tracer in the immobile domain, and that takes a while to decline back to an equilibrium condition. So during this segment of this hysteresis loop, as we call it, you're seeing changes in bulk conductivity. That's the immobile domain, but the fluid conductivity is basically constant because the mobile domain is already cleared out. Now, this is ideal. This is hypothetical, but this is what it approximates pretty well what we see in the data. And if you can graphically analyze your data with this sort of model, you can very easily calculate the ratio of immobile to mobile porosity called the distribution coefficient for this model. The slopes can also give you some of that information. So the theta here is porosity, T is total, M here is a cementation exponent, and that comes from the petrophysics for bulk fluid conductivity relationship. And if you can take this data and plot it versus time, normalize it, you would, in theory, if you have instantaneous loading and unloading of the mobile domain, get on this kind of semi-log plot a fit to data using a straight line. And the slope of that line would be giving you the rate coefficient governing the diffusive exchange. So that's valuable information, otherwise obtained through inverse modeling, model calibration using PassView code and so forth for an MT3D model, again, for a site-wide parameter. But we can do this everywhere we have the electrodes located to get spatially variable parameters. And this is some real data, and it works pretty well. This is for data collected in a column. Actually, this was data collected in the stream bed. These are also other data collected in the stream bed, analyzed with a slightly more complex model technique that we developed for when that instantaneous loading is a poor approximation to reality. So I just wanted to give you a flavor of how this works and what the parameters are that we're going after. We've also been talking with Charles about my collaborator, Lee Slater at Rutgers University, and I have been talking with Charles about applying similar techniques to go after matrix diffusion, not the mobile immobile model, but using electrical techniques to map out effective matrix diffusion coefficient. NMR, you'll probably be hearing a lot about this. The tools have just really been adapted in the last, say, 5 to 10 years for use in the groundwater field. Previously, NMR was used widely in the petroleum field to measure porosity and to differentiate between bound and unbound porosity, and also to estimate hydraulic conductivity. This is a geophysical technique that is directly sensitive to water in the pore space. I'm not going to get into the physics of it today, but that's very valuable to us because most of our techniques that I've talked about yesterday are not directly sensitive to water. They're sensitive to things that may be related to water, like electrical conductivity, but they're not sensitive to the water itself. NMR is. So NMR has been used to estimate hydraulic conductivity and also porosity. And unlike neutron logging, which was done in the past for measuring porosity, this does not have an active nuclear source. So this is easy to use at site. You don't have to worry about losing something downhole that's going to contaminate your aquifer worse than anything that was there before you came to the site. NMR, despite the nuclear in the title, is the same sort of physics that's used for magnetic resonance imaging. So if you ever had an MRI, this is kind of the same physics. We're excited about this for fractured rock because in principle we can measure mobile and immobile porosity with this technique and hydraulic conductivity as well, although that's always involving a transform between the basic NMR measurements, which have to do with the decay time for how a signal goes back to equilibrium in response to a magnetic perturbation. I won't get into the physics here, but again, you basically get bound and unbound porosity and hydraulic conductivity through a Kozani-Karman-like equation that relates pore size distribution to hydraulic conductivity. And this is what the data look like. But the processed NMR data gives you a decay time distribution. This can be converted into a pore size distribution. So not just bound and unbound porosity, but an actual distribution of pore size is present in the rock. And from that, we can estimate hydraulic conductivity using various relations. And for this particular log, where we see the increased porosity, we do have fracturing going on. So that's very encouraging. We see that a lot. And the last technique I want to showcase is cross-hole flow meter logging. And I've mentioned this earlier in the course. We talked about it yesterday. This is similar in implementation to single-hole flow meter logging, but you're pumping from one hole and observing flows vertically in another hole at multiple locations, perhaps also in the pump hole. Although the technique's been around for, probably close to 20 years with a lot of early development at the USGS by Fred Paillet, we published a paper about five years ago with a new forward model that we're now beginning to implement in a graphical user interface. We have a simple spreadsheet interface that we've been using internally, but we want to make a piece of software that can be used easily by others, and we're hoping to get that out in the next 2 years or so. And this is what the configuration looks like. You have one well where you're pumping, and you can measure flows above and below identified fractures or fracture zones, and then you can also measure flows above and below fractures in a second or multiple wells. And from those data, you can pretty quickly qualitatively infer connections in between the wells, but using the model calibration procedure for the cross-hole flow meter logging, you can estimate transmissivity and storage associated with those individual fractures or fracture zones. So whereas the single-hole flow meter is just telling you about conditions local to the well you're testing in, this can begin to tell you about connectivity between wells by fractures. And this is what the data look like and what some of the model fits are. So the reason we're excited about cross-hole flow meter is this is a geophysical tool, a logging tool, that is really implementing a hydraulic test. Again, getting it more direct information about hydraulic properties that are needed to populate numerical models for predictive purposes. That's all I've got. I think Claire's going to come up next. I think we should probably hold off questions until the end of the presentation.
Okay, you may be happy to learn that this is the very last presentation. So I'm going to talk about a method called hydraulic tomography, which strictly speaking is not necessarily a research method at this point. This method has been developed and applied quite a bit in unconsolidated aquifers, but it really hasn't been used much in fractured aquifers, and in particular in fractured aquifers to estimate high-resolution permeability distribution. And really, this application that I'm going to show you, as far as we know, is the first such application at high resolution over a small volume of rock. So this is work by me and my colleague Warren Barish, who's with Boise State in Idaho. Okay, I'll talk about what is hydraulic tomography, or HT, why is it important, and show you an application in the field, and then modeling of those field results to obtain the K estimate. Okay, hydraulic tomography, all it really is conducting a whole lot of hydraulic or pumping tests over a relatively small volume of aquifer. And so you're basically interrogating this small volume of aquifer with a lot of tests, and by virtue of, and you end up with a very rich, large set of drawdown data from those tests. And then in modeling, one can use inverse modeling and estimate K at high resolution. And it's at high resolution because you're doing a lot of tests and you've got a dense distribution of observation locations within this volume of aquifer. So why are we interested in high resolution hydraulic conductivity distribution? Well, hopefully during the last couple days we've stressed and it's come across how the key thing that differs, that differentiates fractured rock from unconsolidated aquifers a lot is this high degree of heterogeneity. And so in these fractured rock systems, we've seen a couple different examples, at least, of where while we pump and treat over decades, but the concentrations do not rapidly decline, and we have persistent contamination even in pumping wells. And this is in large part because we have sort of continued secondary source of contamination in the matrix of these systems and in the lower permeability fractures that's acting as a secondary source and continuing to bleed out into the fractures, and that is seen by the lack of significant reduction in contamination at pumping wells and monitor wells. So as we've shown in a few talks today, we can implement in situ treatments that help to reduce contaminant concentrations in situ and lead to lower treatment costs of pump and treat. And this is where hydraulic tomography comes into play with this. If we understand better the detailed hydraulic conductivity distribution in the source area where we're interested in implementing an in-situ treatment, then we have a better chance of directing those amendments to the areas where the contamination is. And we can better surgically, so to speak, implement those treatments. So that's part of the motivation. So we conducted this experiment at the NOC site, the site in New Jersey in fractured mudstones. The well field that we implemented it in is shown in plan view here. There's six wells in a circle with a seventh well in the middle, and this is a pretty small scale. This is only 9 meters across. Okay, and this well field was actually developed initially for an electrical resistivity tomography experiment by Lee Slater and others. Okay, so this shows a subsurface view of these seven wells. The wells are indicated by their acoustic televiewer logs, which identifies where the fractures intersect the wells. And this shows one of the packer configurations that we used during the hydraulic tomography. And you can see we installed several packers in each well. And then to conduct the test, we would pump from a particular interval and monitor drawdown in three dimensions over most of the other packed off intervals. And we used actually three different packer configurations to fully interrogate packed off short packed off intervals of the full open interval of the well. For example, this packer configuration here largely packs off intervals in the upper part of the well with long open length left at the bottom of the well. We didn't have enough packers to, in one fell swoop, pack off the full open interval. So we had to reconfigure the packers and replace them in the wells a couple of times to achieve full coverage. Okay, so as I mentioned, this involves conducting multiple cross-hole hydraulic test. So just to illustrate that schematically, we might start by pumping at one interval, and then this is supposed to schematically represent the fact that we're then monitoring drawdown in several other intervals in 3D in the well field. Then we're done with that test. We allow some time for water levels to recover, and then we pump in another interval, monitor everywhere, we pump in yet another interval, monitor everywhere, etc. And so over the course of our experiment, which we did in two phases, two different summers, we conducted 47 hydraulic tests, and it each had 30 to 40 observation locations, packed off intervals that were monitored, yielding about 1,500 drawdown curves for the collective set of data. Okay, the other theme of this talk is going to be heterogeneity, and really to emphasize that at very small scales in fractured rock, we can see enormous heterogeneity, and that's partly where the value of hydraulic tomography comes into play in these systems, because this approach allows us to estimate the details of this heterogeneity. So I just want to show you the drawdown data from one test and from a few packed-off intervals of one well to illustrate that heterogeneity. So in this test, we're pumping in this interval here, which is in the central well of the well field, and I'm going to show you data from this observation well here called 88BR. So this brown plane, keep that in mind, this brown plane represents a relatively high K dipping bed that intersects all these wells, and investigations at the site scale prior to conducting this hydraulic tomography showed that this particular bed has connected high permeability fractures over 10 to 100 meters, and we get very rapid transmission of drawdown at the site scale when we pump from this interval at some well. Okay, so we're going to pump here, and this drawdown curve is from this interval in the observation well, which is in the same dipping bed as the pumped well. But it turns out that it's in a lower hydraulic conductivity part of this bed, even though it's only 5 meters from the pumped well, which is in a very high hydraulic conductivity part. So we get actually a rather delayed start of drawdown and a not very large drawdown at the end of the test in this interval. In contrast, at this packed off interval, which is the next one down in the observation well, we see a much earlier response to drawdown response and a much larger drawdown at the end of the test. And even here at the deepest interval in the well, we see a stronger drawdown response compared to this interval in the same dipping bed as the pumped well. And then we can similarly look at drawdown in observations that are shallower than the pumped well. But this really indicates a huge degree of heterogeneity over short distances. And it also indicates that we've got vertical connections through crossbed fractures that are producing these responses deeper in the system to this well, to this pumping. Okay, so to analyze all these data that we obtained from this hydraulic tomography experiment, we use inverse modeling, which is basically just parameter estimation. In this case, we're estimating parameters on a grid of 20,000 hydraulic conductivity blocks. And by this geostatistical inversion method, it allows estimating hydraulic conductivity on a block-by-block basis. So we're not using a discrete fracture model here to estimate the locations of fractures. This is like a heterogeneous continuum type modeling. And so what the approach will do for this fractured rock setting is it estimates volumes in which fractures occur. And you'll see that when I show the results. It estimates high K features with fracture-like geometry. So groups of cells with high K that are locations in the subsurface that where fractures occur. Okay, so let's jump right to the results. This shows a few slices through the volume over which we're estimating hydraulic conductivity. So this is about, this is 10 meters here by 10 meters. So this is slightly larger than the size of our well field. You can see the well depicted as the vertical lines in here. And so then this is like a vertical slice and another vertical slice through the estimated field. And here's a slice that's inclined, and this slice is in the location of that dipping bed that I showed when I showed the drawdown data. And so you can see here along the location of this dipping bed, the results indicate this, or the results estimate a K distribution that represents this extreme hydraulic conductivity heterogeneity. We have very high hydraulic conductivity over here. This pumping well that I showed in that example is right here. And right over here is the 88 BR well that had such a subdued hydraulic response or drawdown when this well pumped. And that data combined with collectively all the other drawdown data lead the inversion to estimate a much, much lower hydraulic conductivity here compared to that in the pumped well. So this is very consistent with what we expected given our qualitative examination of the drawdown data. And then here's a couple of different slices that I show to illustrate this concept where this method estimates sort of high K regions that are inferred to be where higher K fractures occur in the true system. So I've outlined a couple of these here. And you'll note that these fractures have limited extent and they're surrounded by lower K rocks. It's very hard to display a 3D estimate of hydraulic conductivity. We've done that with slices here, but as I mentioned, there are some vertically, the data suggests that we've got some good vertical connections through crossbed fractures in the aquifer, and none of those are shown too well here. There's a slight connection here, but these slices, show one type of important feature that this method is estimating. Also, this method includes one can calculate the uncertainty in the estimated hydraulic conductivity, and that's depicted here, where the bluer colors are smaller uncertainty and the red is larger uncertainty, and this is as expected. We have a relatively small uncertainty at the locations of the wells, which are where our data points are. And then we have sort of a small to moderate to large uncertainty in between wells. And outside of the well field, we see the red colors, and we have much larger uncertainty. And that's because our suite of tests don't inform us much about, or don't inform the inversion about the hydraulic conductivity out there, because we don't have any data. So just a snapshot showing, as I mentioned, we have 1,500 drawdown curves, and this is just a few showing the fit that we yield from that estimate of the K field. The fit to the drawdown data. So the red curves are simulated drawdown. The blue are data from several observation intervals. And we also look at the fit to some locations that we did not use in the inversion. And we see that in general, the fit is quite similar in quality to the fit for data used in the inversion. So sometimes people call this a validation exercise, and usually the term validation is often better applied when we are like assessing the fit of the model to some sort of boundary conditions or pumping conditions that are very different from that we used in the inversion. So we decided to just call this kind of a quality check on the results of the inversion. Okay, as I mentioned, hydraulic tomography is a fairly mature technology with several applications that have been done in unconsolidated aquifers, however, fewer in fractured rock. And so if in order to implement this in the field, there's not really a set of standard equipment, but because the field implementations are very customized depending on the site geology and the fracturing and the well configurations, but the components that are needed to construct packer strings and carry out the tests are readily available. The methods for analysis, this inverse modeling methods, are robust and well demonstrated, particularly in unconsolidated aquifers, and software is available within each group that's carried out this research, but there's no off-the-shelf type of solutions that are available yet for analyzing the data from this method. Okay, takeaway points. This is a robust approach for estimating high-resolution K distribution. And it's probably become clear to you this is quite an intensive field effort and also modeling effort, computational effort. In fact, it really, in our example, we needed to use high-performance computing to keep the computation times tractable at all. So it also benefits from having access to those types of facilities. But we would argue that the expense involved in terms of field and computation effort can be worthwhile when you need to understand small-scale flow and transport processes for achieving whatever your site investigation objectives are and supporting decisions related to contaminant mitigation, if you need to do that on this sort of small high-resolution scale. And so the cost of this improved characterization can be worth it if it ultimately leads to lower costs of the site actions that you implement. If you can use this to help design a more surgical type of amendment injection that improves your remediation effectiveness, then this can be a cost-effective exercise. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Claire and Fred. Did anyone have any questions on research areas?
Nope. Yeah, I have a question. Thank you. I was wondering if you ever taken a nuclear magnetic resonance tool and run it in the same wells that you've done the HT and compare the results between the two?
Nope.
Let me see if you want to say that into the microphone.
Okay. Yeah, Alan's right. We did do that at the NOC site. We did NMR logging at NOC in some of the same wells, I think, that you're showing in this figure. So I don't think we did. We haven't done that comparison. Maybe we should.
Good idea. So for the high resolution tomography,
Is there a way to sort of apply it in concept, but on a larger scale that would be more feasible for bigger sites? You know, the resolution of the borings shown, I guess maybe another way to put it is, what would be sort of a maximum distance, you know, and well density to get some useful data using the method?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, as you get larger, as you get larger in scale, let's say you got out to 20 or maybe 40 meters, you probably would not be, if you, you know, the degree of resolution of your results would depend on the borehole, in part on the borehole configuration that you were going to have. But say you still only had 7 wells over 40 meters. Well, in your modeling exercise, those K blocks might need to be larger. And so that would reduce your resolution right there. And as you get larger and larger, then you could still do a whole lot of hydraulic tests, but maybe you wouldn't be able to actually do the geostatistical inversion anymore, and you'd have to, you know, do some sort of zonation or other approach for representing your hydraulic conductivity. Yeah, Dan.
Like you did for
the shutdown. Yeah, exactly. So you could kind of, I mean, this it's kind of like a continuum, perhaps, of you know, at a smaller scale and with a higher density of observations, you can carry out the geostatistical inversion approach. You may need to have larger hydraulic conductivity blocks, which reduce the resolution. But at some point, you know, you're just not going to have the data density as you get larger to really be able to estimate using that technique.
Wait.
So maybe one of the better applications for that technology would be in, like, say, a Dean Apple source area or some sort of source area where you can really get that detailed resolution where you might need it most. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, exactly. I totally see this as most applicable to, at least when doing it at contaminated sites, to source zones, because that's where you are going to want to, if you want to do some sort of surgical remediation and attack that source zone, that's where you're going to want to do it. Doing it in the tail of the plume, you know, that doesn't give you a lot of bang for your buck.
Okay. Jean, did we have any questions online?
Yeah, we did have a question online. This one is actually coming in from South America, so I just wanted to share the question that came in, and this was about the NMR. The participant wanted to know if the NMR would work in the Vado zone.
NMR has been used in the Vado zone, so I'm not that familiar with applications there. We're mostly working in aquifers and groundwater, but it's used for us. There's research showing it used for estimating moisture and also hydraulic properties in the Vado zone. So if the person with the question wants to get in contact with me, I can send some emails with citations.
Great. Thank you.
Oh, maybe I'll also mention that there are multiple NMR borehole tools available, and I didn't mention this in the talk or yesterday, but the tool that's appropriate to your site is determined in part by the borehole diameter. So the tool is very sensitive to a certain distance away from the tool. So it's sensing a shell, kind of a cylinder around the borehole, and what the porosity is in that cylindrical region around the tool. So you need a larger diameter tool for a larger diameter well. And there are tools that are designed for the Vado zone as well. Some of these are very small tools, and some are actually, they sit at land surface and they get kind of driven into the soil for the vadosone property. So it's not really a borehole tool in that case. But again, I can send some citations offline. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, got another question here in the room.
So I have another question on NMR, because we were recently looking at it to characterize a fractured rock site that was in a gneiss and schist. And Kolog, I think, was concerned about being able to really get porosity estimates because the bedrock primary porosity was so low.
Well, yeah.
And, you know, could you speak to that a little bit? And if you are sort of wanting to identify fracture zones in a more, you know, a low porosity bedrock, you know, whether that would be feasible with the technology?
Yeah, I think this is still an open question that we're researching and trying to figure out at different sites and different geologies. And NMR isn't my particular expertise, so I don't think I'll be able to give a really good answer to that, but I can point to some papers. I think that's a valid concern that your collaborators had. Certainly when you're in lower porosity, there's a limit to what you can see, and if you're working in a gneiss that might be 1 or 2% porosity, I don't know how much variability at that level you would be able to sense. I don't have a good sense of that myself. I can point you to some people who might.
Okay, I think we have another online question.
Actually, we do not. Just a lot of thank you.
Okay. My mistake. Okay. Well, if we don't have any more in the room, I just want to point out real quick, this is a map online of who joined us today. We have about 20 people in the room here at EPA, and also